Lowe's knows to bring your vision to life, it's important to find the right color. That's why Mylowe's Rewards members get a free Valspar paint or exterior stain sample to test your look to confidently refresh your space. Offer valid in-store only 87 to 820. Limit one per customer while supplies last. Discount taken in time of purchase. See associate for details. Rewards program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
Picture this. You are in a courtroom where the defense attorney is literally pounding his fist on the lectern, screaming about prosecutorial misconduct because someone dared to mention that no dog DNA was found on the victim's clothing. Well, that's kind of the reason. This is the same defense team that wants you to believe a Boston police officer was allegedly mauled to death by a German shepherd named Chloe in someone's basement, then dragged outside and planted in a snowbank. But at that time, there was no snowbank. So just out in the middle of their yard, to frame their client. Welcome to June 3rd in the Karen Reed trial, where the defense's desperation has reached levels that would make a reality TV show producer maybe blush a little bit. Welcome. Want to hear your thoughts in the comments if you're watching us on YouTube or X. And if you're listening to the podcast, be sure to check us out over there so you can conversate with us and we can hear your opinions as well. Hit subscribe, everybody, wherever you're watching too, whether it's YouTube, X, if it's wherever podcast platform you're listening on, Apple, Spotify, wherever you may be, we're everywhere. Do hit subscribe so you don't miss any of our coverage of the case. All right, let's get down to it. If you've been following this Massachusetts murder case, you know that it started as a fairly straightforward drunk driving homicide case and has now somehow morphed into what can only be described as a legal fever dream involving canine conspiracies and evidence tampering theories that would make QAnon theorists say, now, hold on, that seems a little far-fetched. But yesterday's courtroom proceedings revealed just how catastrophically the defense strategy is backfiring, with their star expert witness getting systematically destroyed on cross-examination, while their legal team resorted to demanding mistrials every time inconvenient facts seemed to surface. Let's start with Dr. Marie Russell, the defense's so-called dog bite expert from Los Angeles, whose testimony was supposed to be the cornerstone of their alternative theory. Russell's credentials for this specific type of analysis are about as impressive as my qualifications to perform neurosurgery after watching a few medical documentaries on YouTube. She admitted under oath that she's never testified as a dog bite expert before this case and that there are no established professional standards for determining dog bite patterns from photographs. Her methodology relies on something she calls differential diagnosis and pattern recognition, which in scientific terms translates to, I look at it and here's what I think. Okay. But here's where it gets truly absurd. Russell didn't just stumble into this case through normal expert witness channels. She actually reached out to the defense team after reading about the case in the Boston Globe, essentially volunteering her services like an amateur detective inserting themselves into a police investigation. This isn't an objective expert sought out for recognized expertise. This is someone who decided she wanted to be part of a high-profile case and convinced the defense to let her play expert witness. And they're like, okay, well, no one else seems to want to do it, so you seem nice. Maybe? She bought me a coffee early. I don't know. I digress. The prosecution, led by Hank Brennan, methodically exposed the fundamental weaknesses of Russell's entire approach. She's making definitive pronouncements about wound patterns based on looking at photographs on a computer screen from 3,000 miles away with no peer-reviewed methodology to support her conclusions. It's like having someone examine a picture of a car accident and confidently declare it was caused by alien intervention rather than driver error, based purely on their personal interpretation of alien intervention and damage patterns. What makes Russell's testimony particularly devastating for the defense is how it highlights the pseudoscientific foundation of their entire alternative theory. When pressed by Brennan, she couldn't point to any professional organization that would certify her conclusions or any published studies supporting her specific analytical methods. She acknowledged that another expert, Armed Forces Deputy Medical Examiner John C. Walsh, had concluded the wounds were highly unlikely to have come from an animal bite, but she simply dismissed this opinion from someone with presumably far more experience analyzing traumatic injuries. Then came the moment that triggered the defense's complete meltdown. Brennan asked Russell if she was aware that O'Keefe's clothing had been swabbed for dog DNA. This is absolutely relevant evidence if the defense's theory is that O'Keefe was killed by a dog attack, or at least part of this death with a dog attack. Yet apparently mentioning this fact sent the defense team into hysterics, like someone had violated some sacred courtroom taboo. Robert Alessi's explosive reaction was truly something to behold. He demanded a mistrial with prejudice, arguing that Brennan had deliberately introduced prejudicial evidence that the prosecution had chosen not to present through their own witness. The legal logic here is breathtaking in its audacity. The defense wants the jury to believe O'Keefe was killed by a dog while simultaneously arguing that any mention of the absence of dog DNA should be forbidden from discussion. It's like claiming someone was attacked by a bear while insisting that nobody should be allowed to mention the complete lack of bear fur, bear saliva, or bear DNA at the scene. Judge Beverly Cannone, demonstrating the patience of Job, denied the mistrial motion after a 30-minute recess. Her brief response preserved the defense's right for appeal while making it clear she wasn't going to throw out the trial because they didn't like having their theory challenged by actual evidence. When testimony resumed, Russell faced the impossible task of explaining why no canine DNA was found on O'Keefe's clothing despite her confident assertions about a violent dog attack. Her explanations became increasingly strained, so to speak, suggesting that evidence could have been contaminated because the clothing had been on an emergency room floor. This explanation requires believing that a vicious dog attack somehow occurred with such surgical precision that it left no detectable DNA evidence, no fur, nothing, which stretches credibility beyond any, I think, reasonable limit. The cross-examination revealed other problematic aspects of Russell's involvement. She admitted meeting with the defense attorneys multiple times and reviewing extensive case materials, raising some questions about whether her opinions were influenced by the defense team's preferred narrative rather than objective scientific analysis. Her willingness to dismiss contrary expert opinions while maintaining her own conclusions, despite the absence of supporting DNA evidence, suggests someone more interested in advocacy than objective medical assessments, maybe. After lunch, the defense called Sergeant Nicholas Barros from the Dighton Police, apparently hoping he would then provide ammunition for their evidence tampering conspiracy theory. Barros testified about observing allegedly less severe taillight damage when Reed's SUV was initially towed compared to later photographs taken at Canton Police Department. However, this testimony created more problems than solutions for the defense. Barros' documentation of this supposedly critical, crucial evidence consists of exactly one line in his incident report. The vehicle had damage to the right rear taillight. For someone whose testimony is supposedly critical to proving and providing evidence was tampered with, his documentation is remarkably sparse. When questioned by Brennan about this brevity, Barros explained his role was primarily traffic control during the tow, essentially admitting that he wasn't focused on detailed evidence preservation. The prosecution effectively highlighted that Barros has been exposed to extensive media coverage of this high-profile case over the past 3 years. His acknowledgement that he doesn't live under a rock and that coverage is all over social media and the news raises serious questions about whether his current recollections have been influenced by information absorbed since the original incident. Human memory is notoriously malleable under ideal circumstances, but when someone has been marinating in media coverage of an event for years, their memories become increasingly unreliable. Brennan also revealed that Barros had met with defense attorneys at a Boston hotel since his first trial testimony, though Barros claimed he didn't find this unusual. This additional contact between witnesses and the defense team, combined with the media exposure, further undermines the reliability of his current recollections compared to his sparse contemporaneous notes. The defense showed videos from the tow date that the claimed supported Barros's, that they claim supported Barros's recollection, but the video quality makes definitive assessment of damage extent pretty much impossible. The prosecution maintained that the videos actually showed significant damage was already present, and honestly, arguing over grainy footage kind of feels like having art critics debate an emotional content of an abstract painting. What's particularly striking about the day's proceedings is how they expose the fundamental weaknesses of the defense's entire approach. Their alternative theory requires believing in an elaborate conspiracy involving multiple law enforcement officers, civilian witnesses, homeowners, all coordinated with precision that would challenge professional intelligence agencies. According to this narrative, O'Keefe was allegedly lured into the Elbert house, attacked by a dog that somehow avoided leaving any DNA evidence, then carried outside and positioned to make it appear he was struck by a vehicle. Consider the logistics that that theory demands. Multiple people would have had to coordinate the cover-up while intoxicated at a house party, successfully fool multiple investigators, manipulate physical evidence without detection, and maintain absolute silence about their involvement for years, while the case received massive media attention. The complexity required makes Ocean's 11 look a lot like a documentary about realistic heist planning. Meanwhile, the prosecution's case presents a straightforward narrative supported by a physical evidence, witness testimony, and Reed's own statements. She was heavily intoxicated. She and O'Keefe had been arguing. She was observed driving erratically. And she made incriminating statements afterwards, including, "Did I hit him?" before anyone told her O'Keefe had been struck by a vehicle. It's like finding someone standing over a body holding a smoking gun while asking, did I shoot him? But then having their claim that they were framed by an elaborate conspiracy. The defense's legal tactics have become increasingly desperate as their case deteriorates. This marks the second time they've demanded a mistrial with prejudice, essentially asking the judge to end the trial because they don't like how the evidence is developing. In legal terms, this is like rage quitting a video game every time you start losing, except with considerably higher stakes and professional consequences. Their expert witness selection has proven particularly disastrous. Russell was supposed to provide scientific credibility to their dog attack theory, but instead, her testimony revealed the pseudoscientific foundation of their entire alternative narrative. Having an expert who admits she lacks established methodology, peer review, or professional standards while dismissing contrary expert opinions essentially destroys any claim to scientific validity. The prosecution has systematically demonstrated that the defense's theories collapse under basic scrutiny. Their dog attack narrative requires believing that a violent animal assault occurred without leaving any DNA evidence. Their evidence tampering claims rest on the unreliable memory of an officer whose documentation was minimal, and their expert witness essentially admitted she invented her analytical approach herself. What's particularly damaging is how the defense's own witnesses keep undermining their theories. Russell's acknowledgement that no dog DNA was found directly contradicts her confident assertions about animal attacks. Varro's sparse documentation and media exposure undermine his credibility as a witness to alleged evidence tampering. Each witness called to support the defense narrative instead highlights its fundamental implausibility. The courtroom atmosphere yesterday in this trial, it's been thick with the kind of tension that develops when someone's bluff is being systematically called. They're running out of cards to play. Karen Reed sat at the defense table as her legal team's strategy unraveled in real time, with each objection and mistrial demand revealing their increasing panic as reality intruded on their carefully constructed alternative narrative. The contrast between prosecution and defense approaches couldn't have been more stark. While Brennan methodically dismantled witness credibility through careful questioning and attention to evidence, the defense resorted to theatrical outrage and procedural objections whenever facts threatened their preferred storyline. Professional courtroom observers have noted how the defense's constant interruptions and demands for mistrial suggest a team that has lost control of the narrative. From a strategic perspective, today's proceedings essentially destroyed the defense's credibility with potential jurors. When your primary expert admits she lacks qualifications and methodology, while your conspiracy theory requires believing multiple people coordinated an elaborate cover-up without leaving evidence, you move beyond reasonable doubt into fantasy territory. The prosecution has successfully established that Reed was intoxicated, fighting with O'Keefe, driving erratically, made incriminating statements afterwards. The defense's alternative theories require extraordinary leaps of logic and suspension of disbelief that few rational jurors are likely to make. Physical evidence, witness testimony, and basic common sense all point toward a drunk driving homicide rather than an elaborate framework involving killer dogs and evidence tampering. The legal implications extend beyond this specific case. Russell's testimony highlights the dangers of allowing unqualified experts to testify based on invented methodologies, while the defense's tactical choices demonstrate how conspiracy theories can undermine legitimate legal advocacy. Courts depend on reliable expert testimony and good faith legal arguments, both of which were notably absent from the defense's presentation. As this retrial continues, with Wednesday's half-day session, the defense faces the nearly impossible task of recovering from what can only be described as a catastrophic day. They've established that their expert can't provide reliable scientific opinions. Their evidence tampering theory relies on speculation and contaminated memories, and their legal strategy consists primarily of demanding do-overs whenever reality conflicts with their narrative. The prosecution has successfully exposed the defense's alternative theories as elaborate fiction while maintaining focus on the actual evidence. With each passing day, the case increasingly resembles someone trying to convince a jury that up is down, black is white, while actual evidence continues pointing towards the obvious conclusion. At this point, the defense would need intervention from a higher power to convince reasonable people that Karen Reed is the victim of an elaborate conspiracy rather than someone who allegedly killed her boyfriend while driving drunk and is now desperately trying to avoid responsibility for her actions. What are your thoughts, everyone? Tell me in the comments section. And be sure to press subscribe if you're watching us on YouTube. If you're listening to us on any of the podcast platforms, hit subscribe there too so you don't miss any of it. And check us out on YouTube as well. Just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. You can also follow me on X at Tony B Pod. Looking forward to your thoughts. I'm Tony Bruschi. Thank you for watching. We'll talk again real soon.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today.